Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Sunday, September 7, 2014. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker, and thank you so much for tuning into this show, which comes to you every Sunday night on Progressive Radio Network. And if you happen to miss our live show, you can catch up by going to the archive at prn.fm and clicking on shows and scrolling down to the Lifeboat Hour. We have a very special guest tonight, someone who's going to be able to tell us why Leonard Cohen can write a song entitled Everybody Knows and be absolutely accurate. How is it that everybody knows we are living in a time of apocalypse, even if they insist that we aren't? But before we have that conversation, I want to let you know that next week, Mimi Gurman is going to be with us again, and that appearance by Mimi is going to be momentous because, as most of you know, the last time Mimi was on this show was Sunday night, April 13th of this year, when she and I were both Mike Rupert's guests just hours or perhaps less than hours before he left us. So Mimi is going to join us next Sunday night to talk about her work with Radcast in Portland, but also nuclear issues around the world. You will not want to miss her powerful presence on this show next Sunday night. So our guest tonight is Dr. Craig Chalquist. He's the department chair of East-West Psychology at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco and adjunct faculty at Pacifica Graduate Institute, where he teaches eco-psychology, and at John F. Kennedy University, where he launched the world's first certificate in ecotherapy. He is the author of several books, including those of the Animate California Trilogy and Terra Psychology, Reengaging the Soul of Place. He is the editor of Rebirths, Conversations with a World Ensouled, and co-editor of Ecotherapy, Healing with Nature in Mind. His areas of professional interest include depth psychology, eco-psychology, mythology, history, eco-resilient communities, theoretical and qualitative research, phenomenology, and complexity science. He manages the Deep Educator Network at LinkedIn, and his website is chalquist.com. That's spelled C-H-A-L-Q-U-I-S-T, chalquist.com. Craig has also written the foreword to my 2015 book, which is entitled Love in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse, Cultivating the Relationships We Need to Thrive. I'm so honored to have you on the Lifeboat Hour, Craig. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm really delighted to be here.
Well, Craig, I first heard about you last December when your colleague Linda Bazell sent me the link to your YouTube presentation, Conscious Apocalypse, Outliving Our Ruling Institutions. At that time, I was finishing my book, Collapsing Consciously, and when I watched your video presentation, I was blown away at how beautifully our work resonated. In your video, you talk about the archetype of the apocalypse and how we should respond to it. And the first thing I think we should do before proceeding is to take plenty of time to define what an archetype is, because myself, as a longtime Jungian, I still find it difficult to define the word archetype accurately. And we should also clarify how archetypes work in the psyche. They aren't just there. They actively affect our moods and behaviors. So your thoughts on this?
What a big and an even cosmic topic, really. And Jung himself was not consistent about this. As a pioneer person, he came at the issue of archetypes from many different angles, and so when we read his work even now, long after he wrote it, we see all these different perspectives. And it's as though something in the idea of the archetype itself is archetypally diverse. it seems to resist being pinned down somehow, and yet we can get a sense of it. And so when I talk about this, I like to present a couple of concrete examples of what I think Jung meant, because there was one part of his definition of an archetype that he never changed throughout his entire career. And to get at that, if we think about the fact that we live in a world, in a cosmos, that certain key features are recurrent in. So, you know, things, the big realities, the big existential realities like birth and death and transition and those sorts of huge realities that we have across cultures, across times, Jung noticed that those tend to show up in stories. And by story, I don't mean just storybooks, but also in dreams and fantasies and myths. And they often show up as characters. So there might, you might have a character called Death with a capital D, or the Wisdom Goddess is an archetypal figure who appears in the, I was going to say many, but probably all cultures. And so she, in different forms from, that vary from culture to culture, she always comes up. And then the figure of the magician and those sorts of things. So, you know, one way of thinking about this in our culture, which pretends to have no myths but is actually acting them out unconsciously all the time, is that, you know, if you think about our current scientific view of the cosmos being created by a Big Bang 13.9 billion years ago, and, you know, that's an archetypal image in the sense that there are many different mythologies that talk about everything beginning with a cosmic egg spectacularly opening or even exploding. So Jung thought that these outer realities, whether it's an egg opening and letting a bird fly out of it, or other versions of the same thing happening, whatever level of scale, that these are a subjective experience as well as an objective one. So when you think of rebirth and death and transformation and the image of the egg opening and the Wisdom Goddess, they're not only things that are found on the outside, but these mythological figures actually give an image to something that transcends the inner-outer duality that we tend to like to think in. So an archetype is an image of a universal recurrence, especially one that we find key, that we all go through. That's a way of thinking about it. And so one other thought about that is, and this is sort of the archetypes made simple thought. Just as individuals have a rich fantasy life, the same is true of cultures. So we have individual fantasies and dreams, and then we have cultural fantasies and dreams. In American culture, we have the fantasy of the hero achieving great things, and we have the fantasy of progress and other sorts of big mythological motifs going on. So collective fantasies, and when these collective fantasies look like each other and they share images and motifs across cultures, then we can talk about archetypes. So they're very active. They're a psychic system, and so they're always at work in the same way that dreams are always at work.
Yeah, and you mentioned culture, and I wanted to ask you how you see the archetype of apocalypse being played out, and how you see it being depicted in the culture in movies, art, music, and other forms of expression, because I see it everywhere.
Yeah, I do too. And I was laughing before I came on tonight. I was looking at the ad that we came up with. I sent you a picture of myself so that you could put it up, and I posted it at my Facebook public page, and which is Facebook/Chalkless, my last name. And I hadn't noticed it until I saw it, but the picture that I sent you without my intending it to had the ocean behind me. And right next to it was your logo that said the Lifeboat Hour.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, isn't that appropriate? You know?
Perfect, yes.
So, yeah, that's the discourse we're in today is the apocalyptic one. And you know, apocalypse, the word itself comes from an old Greek word that means to reveal something that was hidden. And so in many of the world's myths, apocalyptic times are times when things break loose that have been repressed for a very long time. So they can feel very chaotic, and they're often full of absurdity and splitting and compartmentalizing and being just plain denial. I was reading a news story this week right next to something about, beheadings being carried out of American journalists. Right next to it, there was a piece that said that there's actually a little bit of an industry now where people pay other people to stand in line for the latest iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what an amazing, these two things are going on at the same time, and other things too, you know.
Right.
But, and that there's always some aspect of that in human affairs. There's always some absurdity or some weird conjugations of things. But when a time is apocalyptic, it suffers a breakdown across all major sectors. And so, you know, it's not just that education, for instance, is in crisis right now, and it's not just in the U.S. that it's in crisis. It's in a lot of places. And so medicine, in some ways science itself, government, finance, you know, that when it begins to be systems failure across so many different domains, I think it's fair enough to say that we live in an apocalyptic time.
Right.
A time when entire systems are breaking down. And as part of that, too, there's the old, you know, the good old image of the Titanic sinking. And a lot of scholars have compared our time to that, well, just a lot of people in general. But what makes it especially eerie is that on the real Titanic, which is named, by the way, after the Greek gods, the Titans, who Zeus and the Olympian gods recognized were out of control, so they locked him up in a box on the bottom of the ocean where the liner went down, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the real Titanic, when it hit the iceberg, everybody knew it. But in our case, everybody's pretending that there is no iceberg, and it makes it eerie for those of us who realize that there is one.
Not only eerie, but sometimes downright schizophrenic.
Yeah.
We'll be talking about in a moment, because I have another question for you about that. But, you know, for about the last 7 years, I've been writing and talking about the archetype of initiation, and I've been stating that I believe the collapse of industrial civilization is precisely a planetary initiation. And as you know, initiation is complicated, but the most accurate and succinct description of it for me comes from Michael Mead's 2011 book, Fate and Destiny, in which he says, in traditional cultures, young people would be taken aside and introduced to their inner selves through rites and rituals. Initiatory rites would serve young folks as occasions for self-revelation, as well as opportunities to absorb wisdom from their elders. Meanwhile, the elders could observe the uniqueness of each young person and consider which life path they were intended to follow. Often, the exchange between youth and elders included a conversation about death. After all, a kind of death was required in order that the young people might end the period of childhood, while the elders were facing a more literal death. The youth had to let go of the ways of childhood and let childhood die in order to grow a bigger life, and the elders had to grow deeper as the end of their lives approached. So humans have the archetype of initiation in the psyche, and I believe that whatever childhood wounding we have is intensified by the absence of initiation. And I believe that much of the violence, loss, and dysfunction of our culture is directly attributable to the lack of initiation. And as I've been saying for several years, we're in the middle of a planetary initiation because we've ignored the need for an individual one. And I'd like to hear your thoughts about this or anything I just said.
Yeah, I so much agree with that and your work on that. And I love Michael Mead's work, too. He also had a comment in his book, Men in the Water of Life, which I used to use in my men's groups, where he said, the fire that burns inside of youth need to be added to the hearth of the community. And if it's not, then the youth will burn down the culture just to feel the heat. So I think about global warming and how we have a whole civilization that is built on internal combustion. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, how's that for a metaphor, you know?
Yes, yes.
So when we don't do the internal descent, when we don't do the internal initiation into full adulthood, and of course initiation isn't just for young people, it's for all of us at many stages of our lifespan, then we act it out unconsciously, as Jung and psychotherapists ever since then have pointed out to us, you know. So when we don't have rituals and ceremonies and education that tell us how to make the descent when it's time for renewal, And, you know, and not only psychologically, but culturally as well. And we don't do those things, then we get in trouble. I think of apocalypse that's literally acted out as an unconscious initiation or a failed initiation or a substitute initiation. It's not happening the way that it could, you know.
Yes, and also, you know, one of the things that Jung said was that, you know, we don't have these traditional initiations in our culture, distinct markers for rites of passage. So different events in our lives present us with initiations. For example, divorce or the loss of a loved one or a foreclosure. Or a terminal illness, you know, all of those are initiations that call us to make this descent that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like life itself helps us with that. You know, I don't know who the elders are these days, except for, you know, friends and colleagues that I know personally. I don't see them anywhere in the media. It's just young guys holding guns, you know.
Right.
But yeah, life itself tends to do that. I remember I'm adopted, but in my 20s I found my birth families, which was its own kind of initiation for all of us. You know?
Right.
And you know, when my birth mother died about 6 or 7 years ago, a lot of my friends are psychotherapists because I worked as one myself for some years. And I remember when that happened and I told them what the news was, a number of them, you know, perfectly well-meaning, said, do you need to talk about this in therapy with somebody? You know, you just lost your birth mother, and it was, you know, all the stuff that's around that for you emotionally. And I thought it was such an odd question because, along with it, they would ask me, "What are you doing about it? What are you doing about the mourning and whatever other feelings are coming up?" And I would tell them, "I'm sitting with it. I'm letting them go through me and transform me and do whatever they want because they have their own schedule."
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to sit with that. And I think that's one of the things that when life initiates us, it asks us to do. It asks us to actually be in the place of pain and uncertainty long enough to be transformed by it instead of immediately trying to fix it or, you know, to work it through or whatever it is. And I'm not saying that to criticize psychotherapy, but I think our models of change need some reworking in the light of what you're talking about, initiatory processes that are transcultural, actually, in some ways.
Well, you know, that kind of brings up another topic. I want to talk about the infantilization of our culture, but I also wanted to just talk about that. You know, this whole issue right now of global warming, catastrophic climate change, the possibility of near-term extinction, all of these are initiations that we're being asked to really sit with because there's not a lot we can do about it, but there's much that we can do with it in terms of allowing it to transform us, allowing it to connect us with the earth and with other people and with our deep soul psyche.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Yeah, it's in a way it's almost too much for some of us anyway to take in all at once. A couple of years ago I went to see a presentation of the rebooted version of Inconvenient Truth. I'd seen the film when it came out, and Al Gore has been training people to do updated versions of it. And so there was a guy here in the Bay Area who was presenting it, and he asked some of us who are ecologically involved in things to give him some helpful critiques. And one of the things I noticed about the slideshow that he presented was that the video was amazing and the scientific facts were incredible and it was all good science and accurate and all that. But it was so devastating that I think there were about 25 of us, 30 of us in the room, and we're all people who know what's happening with the planet, you know, or not even the public. And who doesn't know? And I think about half the group left before the slideshow was even over.
Right.
They just couldn't hold it, you know.
Right.
So as part of this huge planetary initiation, and I think that's a great framework for understanding multiple environmental crises that we're now in, and making sense of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In the midst of all that, the question that raised for me was, how can we support each other and talk about how we feel about all this? As we go through it, because if we don't have safe containers to put it in. If we don't have places where we're safe talking about it, then we won't process it, and it'll just numb us out.
Absolutely. And, you know, the next question that I want to ask you, which I alluded to a moment ago, is, you know, the infantilization of people in our culture due to lack of initiation. And I realize that it's hard for even the most initiated person to hold this information. But, you know, we live in a culture where most people aren't initiated and they have been infantilized. And Jung wrote a great deal about the puer or the puer mentality. And he wrote mostly in reference to males because of the time that he lived in. But the puer or puella in the case of the female is the immature psyche that never finishes growing up. And I think it's very important to understand this concept in relation to the infantilization of people in our culture. Would you say more about that?
Yeah, I talked to Rick Tarnas about that once, and his opinion was that we live in a puer culture. And puer, of course, is the Latin word that literally means boy, and Jung thought of that as kind of the archetype of the divine child, you know, who's full of ideas and inspiration but never really lands. And it's not an entirely negative idea, but when we get caught in it, when we get caught in an archetype like that, then, you know, it lives us instead of us living it, and then we have the result of entire cultures that are emotionally immature. I sometimes doubt whether one person in 100 can actually sit with their feelings when they're upset without immediately trying to change the environment or change other people, you know. Yeah, and of course, I mean, I can't even watch TV anymore because it's so insulting. It's just, you know, do you want a sandwich that's tasty? And I just can't stand that, you know. It's like, I don't need to be talked to like a three-year-old, and nobody else does either, and we wouldn't put up with it if we weren't conditioned to from, you know, infancy.
Right.
So it makes it even more important to seek out the people around us who are real elders, not just oldsters, as James Hillman would put it, just people who get old but they never grow up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the real elders who at least have some degree of emotional initiation into adulthood so that they can be guidance for the rest of us.
Yeah.
It's so important.
Yeah, and, you know, on this show a couple of times I've had younger people on. I had Tyler Hess on August 3rd. I had Adam Bucko last week. And, you know, these are younger guys, and they're very wise. They're very wise.
Yeah.
They're wise beyond their years. And I playfully call them elders sometimes because they have a lot more wisdom than some middle-aged or senior citizen folks that I know. And so elderhood is not about age as much as it is about deep wisdom.
Yes. Yeah, I do think there is a chronological component to some extent. I notice that with me as I get older, but yes, it's not. It doesn't just come down to that. I mean, there's plenty of people who are, you know, 60, 70, 80 who just never learned a damn thing, pretty much. But and then on the other side of it, what you're talking about, I'm thinking of students of mine too. I teach a lot of graduate students, and some of them are in their 20s and 30s, and a few of them I've said, you know, I wish I had had half your sense when I was your age.
Exactly.
You know, it's amazing. I mean. The maturity and the balance and the integrity and the dedication to higher causes, it's just so rewarding to witness that.
It really is. We're going to take a station break for about a minute or so, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker, and I'm talking with Dr. Craig Chalquist, professor of psychology, author, and eco-psychologist. He teaches at California Institute of Integral Studies and is the co-editor of Ecotherapy, Healing with Nature in Mind. Craig, what is the best way for listeners to get in contact with you?
Probably either through my public Facebook page, which is Facebook/my last name, which is Chalquist, or you can go through my website, which is chalquist.com. Those are probably the easiest ways.
And let me just reiterate the spelling, Chalquist, chalquist.com. I mentioned Linda Bazell a moment ago. She was my guest on this show on Mother's Day of this year. It was completely appropriate, and she spoke at length about eco-psychology and eco-spirituality. And I'd like you to define what these two terms mean to you, and I'd also like to hear from you how eco-psychology and eco-spirituality can help us stop denying apocalypse and help us begin embracing it.
Sure. Eco-psychology... you know, it's a fairly recent thing, but it's, you know, maybe 10 years old or so, but it draws on ancient traditions. And it actually started here in the Bay Area when some psychologists and environmentalists and political activists got together, and they began asking each other, why is it that psychology and including psychotherapy and ecology are not talking to each other? Is it not obvious that we're not just, our psychology does not just confine itself to our heads or our relationships, that we actually have an ongoing active relation to the world that we're born into, and that the health and sickness of our environments have a lot to do with how we feel. So eco-psychology looks at that. It looks at the health and pathology of our surroundings, and it asks itself, you know, how are we affecting our surroundings, and how are they affecting us also? So it actually puts us back into nature and where we evolved and where we always live and always depend on. So it's psychology bringing back nature. Linda likes to say as though nature matters, which of course it does. And that's eco-psychology, I should mention, also includes ways to get back in contact with the natural world consciously. So putting your hands in the soil for 20 minutes and then feeling how it begins to influence your brain chemistry positively, such that there's now research that the soil bacteria can actually elevate mood as well as or better than psychotropic medications for at least some people. So there's your antidepressant right in fresh soil if you just garden without gloves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the sorts of things that eco-psychology preoccupies itself with, and also the research about this. Another thing that comes from that field is that, you know, diversity is sometimes criticized as being this kind of politically correct term. People who actually work with it know that it's not. It's much more than that. But the interesting thing is that, you know, when you have diverse human cultures, you know, the richness and the health that comes out of that is far superior to just having one kind of anything. And in the same way, variety is also the spice of life in nature, in the sense that if you walk through a garden with lots of different kinds of plants, it actually has more of a healthy effect on your mind and body than if you walk through a field with only one kind of plant.
Hmm.
So there's all these connections that eco-psychology looks at between culture and nature, which it doesn't hold as separate or split off from each other, and inner and outer as well. So that's a really brief look at eco-psychology. And then eco-spirituality, which it goes by different names. It's, there's a study out of Yale now called Religion and Ecology, and they've got a lot of really excellent articles online about that. But eco-spirituality goes back to the indigenous traditions that do not separate heaven or spirit or the gods from our earthly existence. Nature-based spirituality, and when I think about this, I often remember how both my Norse and Celtic ancestors told stories in which you could be out looking through a meadow and enjoying yourself or hunting or whatever it was, and then suddenly an animal with a unique color appears and it leads you on a journey, or a magical castle comes out of nowhere. And the feeling in these stories is that these otherworldly magical realities are not separate from the hunt or from the walk or from the meadow, that they actually are behind it somehow or within it somehow. So eco-spirituality goes beyond the usual dualisms of heaven and earth or this world and the other world, and says, you know, the sense of sacred, the sense of reverence for something beyond ourselves has to do very much with being in touch with what's here. That it's imminent. It's not just out there somewhere.
Thank you for that very, very extensive but also really succinct description and definition of those two terms. And I want to give our listeners a heads up that we will be taking calls tonight. So again, in case I need to remind you, the number is 888-874-4888. I'm going to continue asking Craig some questions, but feel free to call in, and we'll try as best we can to take your call. So another issue that I want to share with you, Craig, and kind of pick your brain on is you know, many people come to me for life coaching, and repeatedly people tell me that when they've tried to connect with a therapist about their despair or depression or anxiety about the state of the world, they've been pathologized or offered medication or somehow told that their emotional responses are related only to their childhood wounding, as if it's dysfunctional or mentally unhealthy to feel their feelings about our collective predicament. What would you like to say to therapists about this, and what would you like to tell clients who feel the feelings that I've been describing about the state of the world?
Mm-hmm. Read the news. Watch the news. You know, I mean, and see how you feel about it. I mean, I have a lot of friends and colleagues who are therapists, and they're looking for therapy for how they feel when they hear about, you know, rising oceans and darkening atmospheres and things like that. So at this point, therapists are being upset by this news as well as everybody else, you know.
I'm very glad to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah, and the other thing is the mechanical paradigm, for my students, I call it the big world, the big machine worldview, that comes out of the Industrial Revolution and the Scientific Revolution. It has been a very powerful framework in a lot of ways. I mean, we're using technology that came out of it to have this conversation. But it's important to understand that a framework is a framework, and that a perspective is a perspective, and it's not reality. It's a working fiction. So psychology has really been caught up in the mechanical fantasy to the point where it ignores the deeper connections that we have with the natural world. So I would invite therapists of every stripe, psychotherapists and social workers and counselors and psychiatrists and everybody to, for one thing, step outside and see how you interact with the natural world and the effect that it has on your moods and your at-homeness in your own body, but also to start questioning your paradigm, to start asking yourself whether this mechanical way of seeing everything is really serving you well, either with your clients or even in your own life.
Thank you for that. You know, so many people really need to hear that. I mean, just people who are not therapists need to hear that. And you are such a bright light in that way because, you know, a lot of folks don't know that therapists, any therapists feel this way or that some therapists are seeking therapy for how they feel about the state of the world. And it's really good to hear that. Now, this past week in Huffington Post, one of your amazing articles appeared called Practical Dreaming in the Hopeful Light of Earthrise. And I posted the article on Facebook and also on my website, but I inserted an editor's note that said, this article does not offer hopium, but rather the power of imagination to create inner transformation as we face apocalypse consciously. So please tell us what inspired you to write the article and what you're trying to communicate in it.
Sure. I love that word, hopium.
Yeah, well, there's lots of it going around.
It really, yeah, it is. It's everywhere. You can get it on every street corner now.
Right.
Yeah, it's maybe a good way to do that is, part of why I read the article is that I wanted to distinguish between what I think of as false or inauthentic hope and the real kind,
mm-hmm.
Because it's a distinction that's been helpful for me, and I wanted to share it with other people. And, you know, there's a lot to be hopeless about. There's no doubt about that. I mean, you know, the oceans may be dead in a couple of decades, and we won't survive that. And even if they weren't, you know, in 3 or 4 decades, a lot of our capital cities will have to be abandoned because of extreme heat, according to the latest science. And we need to know that. We need to hear those things.
Right.
And that, of course, if we do nothing, if we just let things go as they are, you know. But so when I think about false hope, when I worked as a psychotherapist, and I continue to see this in the public arena all the time, it's a hope that I actually think is a coin flip away from despair that's not being acknowledged. So I hear sometimes people, when I mention facts like the ones I just did, they'll say some things like, well, you know, the scientists like to exaggerate, and I think, well, not really. I mean, that's not their job to exaggerate. If you looked at mm-hmm. the data, or they'll say, oh, well, we'll invent our way out of this, you know, and I ask them, when in history did we ever do that? I mean, did we ever mm-hmm. really get out of any kind of a crisis that was already killing us, you know?
Right.
Or just plain denial, oh, that can't be true, you know, because why? Because you don't want to believe it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I look at things like that as false hope. You know, the kind of there's a term that's been used a lot recently, spiritual bypass.
Right.
That would be an example where you just kind of whistle past the graveyard and you know, tend your own inner journey and maybe do some journaling and burn a little incense and think that that's going to change everything, you know.
Right.
And not that those aren't good things to do for you, but they're not going to change the world. I mean, we've been meditating as a species since we've been here, and look how things are, you know.
Right.
So so that's what I think of as false hope. And then, but the other kind of hope, I think, is I hold it more as a mood or as some sort of an emotional accompaniment to another state of mind, which is faith. And by that I mean holding open the psychological space that things can be better, that it doesn't have to be this way, that we don't have to destroy ourselves as a species, and that it is possible to turn things around. So I noticed, too, that the word hope in Spanish and other Latin languages also means to wait or to expect.
Right.
So for me, it's a psychological posture of saying, I expect more from us. And when I did, I worked a lot with guys who were in jail and prison, and then they came out and were sentenced to be with me.
Yeah.
And my groups, you know. And sometimes I would tell them, you know, I expect more from you than the usual violent, abusive behavior. I expect you to grow up and be peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
And men afterwards who were successful graduates of our programs sometimes told me that that was the most powerful part of it for them, not the anger management skills, not the communication skills and all that, but to actually have another man tell them, I see more in you than this.
Right.
You're better than this. And so
yeah.
When I look at all the crap in the news, I know human nature well enough to know that we are so much better than all that.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, hope is the state that says we can do something positive with this dreadful situation, and I continue to maintain that. And so I've noticed that when I present that publicly or I say it in my classrooms, it has a galvanizing effect on other people who are hopeless. I think hopelessness can be deadly for some people. It keeps them from acting. It makes them lost in despair.
Right.
You know, and sometimes I think a call to hope, if it's realistic and it actually takes the situation as it is, can be like a bugle blown to some people where they go, okay, now I at least have something to hope for, so now I'm going to get active and I got to figure out what I need to do, you know.
Well, as Edward Abbey said, hope action is the antidote to despair. Action is
Absolutely.
The antidote to despair. And so
yep.
Regardless of the outcome, we need to be acting. We need to be
yes.
serving. We need to be giving to other people and, you know, just doing what's in front of us and doing what we know is the right thing. I want to remind our listeners, please call in. We are very available to take your calls, your comments, your questions. This is a great opportunity to ask Craig some questions or make a comment to him. 888-874-4888. And back to your article that you wrote in Huffington Post, I want to ask you a very direct question about imagination, because in this article you write extensively about the imagination or imagining how things could be different. This is kind of what you just talked about, but I'd like to sort of ask the question in a different way. A lot of people would say there's an enormous evidence for the likelihood that we're facing a sixth great extinction. If that's even possible, let alone probable, what good does it do to imagine how things could be different? What do you say to that?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, when I was younger, I went through this period in my 20s where I got myself into all these really dangerous situations. And, you know, I was certain several times that I was going to die. And I think anybody looking at the situation from the outside would have come to the same conclusion. I was in real danger and I was going to die. And then something would just happen at the last minute and change everything. And so part of what that taught me was not to give up and not to just despair, because in a couple of those situations, if I had given up, I would have died. So there was really nothing to hope for in the rational sense. But one of the things it taught me was that I can't know the total situation. I'm not wise enough. And in the same way, even when we have these dreadful statistics, and at this point the scientific evidence for what we're doing to the planet is quite clear. There's really no rational debate about it anymore. You know, even in the face of all that, I think we have to remind ourselves, we're still just getting to know this planet. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't know 10 years ago that dolphins talk in dialects.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know 15 years ago, before the work of Paul Stamets, that mycelium, which are those nice fungi in the first inch of topsoil, actually regulate entire ecosystems. You know, they're like a brain in the ground, funneling nutrients to sick parts of the ecosystem and to make trees flower when they're having trouble and things like that, you know. So there's an intelligence at work in the earth that seems to be quite beyond our ability to rationally interpret, at least for now. So I think it's always necessary to have some humility about our own predictions. So that, I think that opens a little space for hope too. But the other part of what you asked, so given that things do have a certain sense of uncertainty, that we're really not powerful enough to predict exactly what's going to happen, working with different survivors of trauma and abuse showed me that one of the most devastating things that could happen to them was to lose the capacity to imagine a better future. And if they couldn't imagine a better future, they wouldn't have one.
Mm.
They wouldn't be able to work toward one. And there are a few rare people who can. I've had periods of my life where I'm totally without hope, and yet I move forward anyway. But for most of us, that's really hard to do, if not impossible. And so I've found that if we can imagine how things might be different, then we might take a few steps toward actually making them different. And I've seen that happen a lot, too. I don't know how many people I've known who've told me, I never thought that I could rejuvenate my community, or that I could make things grow in this barren landscape, or that I could do this or that. And they were able to do that because they imagined it and then moved forward with it. So I think imagination can be extremely powerful. And, you know, when you think about all the great achievements of humanity, they all start as a fantasy, every one of them. Hunch, you know, scientific hunches and battle plans and the ideas for cities and all of it, artistic creations, they all begin in fantasy.
Right. Very good point. We have Dave from Illinois who wants to comment on what you're talking about. Go ahead, Dave. Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
Hi. Thank you very much. And my comment is this. I've been following this whole idea of near-term human extinction now for a couple of years, mostly through Guy McPherson's work, but also through you, Carolyn, and your show, et cetera. And I really find myself isolated mm-hmm. from people, because people do not want to talk about this in any serious manner that I can find. I shouldn't say across the board, but generally. And I'm talking about intelligent people that I will work with or associate with or are friends. And I feel very isolated at times, and I'm wondering if there's a path through this isolation that is viable. You know what I'm saying? It gets very frustrating.
Do you have any comments for that, Craig?
Doing what you're doing makes the path. I've noticed with me that when there's something bothering me, and this is a significant thing, of course, because it affects all of us, it's really important for me to have other people to talk to about it, but they don't tend to show up until I'm ready for them to, and that means that I'm bringing myself to voice to the degree that I can, whether it's putting comments out on the Internet or having private conversations with people I feel safe with or whoever, because then they'll start spreading the word, too, and then before you know it, you have a network of kindred souls who are all concerned about the same thing. So, you know, it's on the one side of it, there's the need for the support to start with, but on the other side of it, very oftentimes it doesn't fully show up until you take a risk or two. And you might talk to, you know, 20 people. Let's say the odds are 20-1 that you'll ever find someone to talk to about it. You know, you might talk to 20 people who say, oh, that's depressing, I don't want to deal with that. And then the one person shows up. So you've just done it, you know, and then they'll lead to other people. So I would keep putting what you need out there and then seeing if people respond. But one other thing about it, too, is I learned as a psychotherapist that I have to meet people where they are. And so oftentimes when I'm talking to, for instance, an audience about climate crisis, if I feel like they're shutting down, then I'll try to approach it through a way that I think they'll be amenable to. And this is such a huge issue, they need support too, you know? So,
right.
and I try to provide a little bit for them. So part of it is that too, is knowing your audience and then doing it to the degree that they can really understand it.
Also, Dave, you probably know about the Near-Term Extinction Support Group on Facebook.
Yeah, I'm on there. You probably see me on there.
Yeah, I probably have.
I make a lot of wisecracks mostly.
Yeah, more than 2,000 people are on that support group. And, you know, another thing is to create with what you feel about this. Do a lot of writing, journaling, and just, you know, write on the computer about it, maybe write some articles someplace and, you know, write your comments on blogs. And if you play music or you do art, you know, put your creativity into that as well. Put your feelings and your passion into this. And I think what Craig says about meeting people where they are is really important. You know, it may start with talking about the weather and then just moving into more profound things. And it may go slowly with a lot of people.
Yeah, I guess a lot of times, too, I find myself preaching to the choir, especially on the Facebook or something where people just totally across the board agree with you. And then there will be one person step in there, a troll or whatever, who will then say, oh, you're all full of it. So I really have a hard time, though, finding people that are kind of on the fence, you know, mm-hmm. that will actually discuss and have a real discussion about these issues. And because most people, I think I run into, are too busy with their lives or something, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But, hey,
you know, one thing to remember, too, is that this is rapidly changing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so much news about, you know, floods and storms and all the rest of it that I would predict that in 5 years there will be almost nobody who's in denial about this because it's happening so rapidly.
That's exactly right. As a matter of fact, I'll just mention my book with Guy McPherson, Extinction Dialogues, is coming out in a couple of weeks. And for the last 2 or 3 months, as we've been finishing up, he has been changing the research, adding research every week. You know, pages and pages of additional research, because that's how fast it's been changing. And in fact, we have to wait till the next edition to put in some of the things that he's been adding right at the last minute. So sure. Craig's absolutely right. It's changing very rapidly.
Well, I got to say that's one of the things that really caught my ear and eye about Guy McPherson is that going back and looking at his videos, that if you go through them from 5 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, you can see that progression very rapid.
Right.
And that to me tells the story that people aren't listening to. You know, that this information is coming along and coming along, and you got to keep looking at this information and not just brush it aside and say, "Oh, well, look, it was a cold winter. Ha, oh, global warming. Ha, oh," you know.
You know what, Dave, we got to run because we got another caller, but thank you so much for calling in. And Craig, would you just take a couple of minutes to tell us about your new certificate of applied mythology, which people can earn online, and why we should be interested in that?
Sure. So I started it through the Deaf Psychology Alliance, which is an international organization created by a former deaf psychology student of mine who is interested in Jung's work, Bonnie Bright. And it's a hangout place online and also basically a school for people who want to talk about dreams and myth and story and psyche and psychology. There's incredible resources there. And so through them, I've set up a series of webinars that actually look at mythology as something that's a practical tool for personal transformation, but also for understanding the times that we live in. So this, just as one example, this figure of the apocalypse that we've talked about, it's not just a Christian image. It appears in other pantheons and other myth systems. And my Norse ancestors called it Ragnarok, the death of the gods. And they said that it began with two things, with major alterations of weather and with altered patterns of animal behavior. And so these stories are not just old relics in books, they come back to life all the time, because myth is a basic psychic structure that all human beings share in terms of how we see the world. It's all around us. And so the Applied Mythology Certificate helps people understand what the myths are that we're living in and how to actually address them in an active way.
Well, that may actually lead into a question that Youssef has for us. Youssef is calling from New Jersey to talk about how to deal with what's going on in the world. Go ahead, Youssef.
Yeah, how you doing? Thank you for your program. Hey, Colin, quickly before, I just have to say that I've been listening to you all the time. I feel like most of your topics are kind of like philosophical to me. But here's my question, my concern, though. Like everybody else, I see all the time war, deaths. I see destruction of the environment, the earth, and all those bad things. But it looks to me like there is nothing that people or humans are doing to fix this, even though people like you are working so hard. To me, it's like so, as it's not significant. Here's my question, though. I was born and raised, I'm still born and raised Muslim, and what I was taught as a kid is that when the end of time comes, this is thing we should be seeing. So my question to you and your guests is it, what do you think about those teachings, and is there really anything we can do to change the situation?
Go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead, Greg.
Thanks, Youssef. Great question. I can answer it as a mythologist and as a depth psychologist. I'm not competent to answer it religiously, so I can't deal with it on that level in terms of the validity of people's beliefs and things like that. So I won't even touch on that. But so the image of apocalypse, the archetype of apocalypse, comes up whenever entire civilizations are in desperate need of renewal because the old institutions and forms are wearing out. And when that unfolds unconsciously, it makes it really hard to make a difference in the world. And it also creates a feeling of trying to swim up against the stream, because the whole force of the archetype, the whole pressure of it is about, in the first part of it, about collapse, about descent, and so we're in that, and so creating projects to counter it is an uphill battle all the way. But the other part, of
if
it
you'd
is
like to make a call, please hang up and try again. If you need,
yep.
Go ahead, Greg.
Interrupted, I think. So the other part of it is the upswing, the renewal that happens afterwards, and that's in the old stories too. So my preference always is, in an apocalyptic time, regardless of what our beliefs are about it, to look for the seeds of renewal in the crisis and to see if we can address them somehow. So rather than taking it entirely literally, because that's part of what feeds it, you know, is to say, well, it's a literal end of the world and there's nothing we can do about it. It's to actually work with it in such a way that it's not the end of the world, it's the end of a worldview that's not serving us anymore. You know, this mechanistic relationship that we have toward the natural world. That gets me further, I think, than just submitting to it, and me personally, anyway.
Thank you for your call, Youssef. We're out of time. I want to thank Craig for being with us tonight. You can contact him at www.chalquist.com. And please come back and be with us next week. We're going to have Mimi Gurman from Radcast in Portland talking about her work. And I just thank you so much, Craig, for your work and for being with us tonight. We'll see all of you. Go ahead, Craig.
I was just going to say thank you so much for having me on.
You're very welcome. And we'll see all of you next week. Have a good week, everybody.
Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows.